Now let me begin with just asking our audience a little poll. And we always ask these polls just because we want to understand the different level of what the audience are expecting from the discussion and how we should be pitching that. So our first poll, we'll be asking two polls, one at the beginning, one at the end of the webinar. And the first one is, how much do you know about IMF debt sustainability frameworks? First option is not much at all, only that some countries are debt distressed and others are not. Second option, a little, but I'd like to know more. And third option, I know it in depth and I have strong views on it. So which one have you picked? Let's close the poll and find out. Okay, we have actually quite a few who are, we've got a kind of a tie between those who know a little but want to know more and those who know it in depth and have strong views on it. So I think we could probably, I think that should hopefully be helpful for our panelists in thinking about where we will, about how we will pitch the discussion. And so let's begin, let's go straight to our panel in order to actually discuss, to begin. So I have three, as I mentioned, I've got three fantastic panelists here with us today. I'll begin with Dr. Yan Wang, who is a senior academic researcher at the Global Development Policy Center at Boston University. She's also the senior visiting fellow at the Institute of New Structural Economics at Peking University, and also an academic committee member of the International Financial Forum. She previously worked as a senior economist and a team leader in the World Bank for 20 years, and she also coordinated the OECD Development Assistance Committee and China Study Group for 2 years. And she's written several books, dozens of papers and country reports, and also received several awards in economics as well. So we're really pleased to have her with us today. Thank you, Dr. Wang, for joining us. We also have Dr. Brian Pinto, who is the former senior advisor at the World Bank, former chief economist at Emerging Markets at GLG in London. He's joining us very early this morning, so we're really grateful to him for doing that. But most importantly, in terms of this debate, between November 2015 and September 2018, he served as advisor to the African Development Fund's Policy Innovation Lab and consultant to the African Development Bank. And he worked specifically on the development and debt sustainability implications of concessional development finance for African countries, and also was one of the main contributors to a report in 2017, a high-level panel report on reinvigorating African concessional finance, transforming trust in the African Development Bank into influence. So he's also written several books. His second book in particular, again, is very relevant to this discussion, How Does My Country Grow?, which was published in 2014. So thank you also, Brian, for joining us today. And last but not least, we have Ms. Ma Ekeruche, who is a research fellow at the Center for Study of the Economies of Africa. She's joining us from Nigeria. She runs a column, Your Nigerian Economist, on Steers Business, Africa's leading business publication, and has focused on her work on public finance, macroeconomic management, and she's been working with Brookings, United Nations Office on South-South Cooperation, Southern Voice, Africa Portal, and was awarded the IMF Youth Fellowship in 2020. So we're really pleased to have Mo with us as well today. Thank you all for joining us. So let me put a few questions to you all to kick us off. And you know, try and set the scene a little bit, if that's possible. It's a challenging topic, that's for sure, but a really, really important one. Now we know our audience say that they know a bit about the quite a bit about the sustainability framework, but maybe those who are watching this later might not. So Brian, perhaps you could give us an introduction on the debt sustainability framework and what that, the one that is kind of constantly in use, which is the IMF's framework, and how that works.
Thank you. First of all, thank you, Hannah, to you and to Rosemary for inviting me and accommodating me by starting 30 minutes later. The LIC DSF, or Low-Income Country Debt Sustainability Framework, developed by the IMF and the World Bank, was originally conceptualized and implemented in 2004 to support the heavily indebted poor countries program, as well as the multilateral debt relief initiative. Its focus is, at that time, you know, the original LIC DSF was largely on what you might call debt distress episodes in relation to publicly guaranteed external debt. Not only that, but it actually looked at the present value of this debt. Now, this was entirely appropriate at that time because most of the debt was owed to official creditors, and it was at very low interest rates. And therefore, it made sense to calculate the debt burden by looking at the present value of the debt. Now, this framework was basically used right up to the end of 2017. In the middle of, starting in the spring of 2016, the IMF decided to recall what it called a significant overhaul of the LIC DSF to take into account the need for a greater emphasis on public debt, on the new realities of more market-based finance, vulnerabilities related to foreign exchange reserve adequacy, etc. So the intentions were good, but eventually when they produced the new framework, it was hard to distinguish from the old one because the emphasis was still very much on debt distress with regard to the present value of public and publicly guaranteed external debt. Now they also brought in public debt, so because you have a domestic component to it as well. But in terms of looking at debt distress, they've come up with these thresholds linked to what they call debt distress episodes. For example, on the external side, it tends to be IMF-centric. Arrears to the IMF play a big role. Mm-hmm. On the public side, they look at what they call financial repression and things like that. So this is basically the framework. It's updated. There is a little more emphasis on public debt, but there's no fundamental change from the old framework. You know, the same, it was essentially an updating. It was not, in my view, a significant overhaul. Now, Hannah, do you want me to stop here, continue with the first question that you raised, or come back to it later on what role it has played with regard to COVID-19?
Yeah, well, I think that would be a good question. I mean, how many countries, you know, what have countries become more debt distressed according to the IMF over COVID-19 period? And what does that really mean in practice?
Sure. Now, COVID-19, first of all, in economic parlance, is what you would call an unanticipated exogenous shock. It was completely unanticipated, not just in Africa, but for the whole world. No one expected a pandemic. It was declared a pandemic about 1 year ago at this time by the WHO. So no one anticipated this. It's different, for example, from a terms of trade shock. it's closer in its effect to the effect, you know, the consequences of climate change on drought in Africa, on agriculture. So it's more of a humanitarian disaster. Now, what would we expect from COVID-19? Obviously, two things immediately. First, the fiscal deficits are going to deteriorate. Secondly, growth is going to slow down. Both of these are going to worsen public debt dynamics. And then you're going to have some spillovers into possibly higher interest rates and second, into current account deficits. So so the question is, has it worsened debt sustainability? Yes, the short answer is yes, because, and the reason for that is that debt sustainability, especially public debt sustainability, had already become a major issue already, I would say, by the spring of 2016. So 5 years ago, it was clear that public debt dynamics were beginning to deteriorate in many of these countries. And certainly by the fall of 2017, the IMF had accepted this, and it was also released a paper in the spring of 2018, where it acknowledged there were serious problems with debt sustainability, and was already beginning to talk about debt restructuring even before COVID-19. Yeah. So the only thing I've seen on the most recent numbers, because I'm sure they'll be doing an update for the spring meetings. But in November 2020, the director of the Strategy, Policy and Review Department of the IMF was interviewed, and she noticed in LICs, as in low-income countries as a whole, roughly 50% of them are now either at high risk of debt distress or actually in debt distress based on the LIC DSF. So the situation has been deteriorated. Just one final point. Has the LIC DSF been used to model the impact of COVID on debt dynamics, either by countries or the World Bank and the IMF? I don't know the answer, but my guess is that the effects of COVID have not been separated out. Right. My guess also is that the impact on spending is easier to measure than on revenues or growth, which are, you know, also crucial. Yeah. And of course, from a conceptual point of view, especially in poor countries, given the humanitarian nature of the disaster, you want to treat COVID with grants rather than with further borrowing.
Yeah. So let me bring in Dr. Wang there, because there is a question of whether there are a number of critiques of the debt sustainability framework. Of course, you know, there's no economic framework that doesn't have its critiques. But there are some pretty strong ones. Perhaps even just from the starting point of, we know that the framework is applied to low-income countries and not applied to other countries. That, of course, means you will end up, when there are instances of debt sustainability being reported, it will be mostly low-income countries, of course. It will be only low-income countries, and that gives us a slightly distorted picture. But there's a lot more behind that, and there's lots more challenges in terms of the economics when it comes to debt sustainability. Dr. Wang, you've done so much work in this area. What would you say are the key challenges?
Many thanks, Hannah, for your kind introduction. I will first briefly make three major points and then elaborate during the Q&A session. First, two critiques on the IMF's DSF framework. So the first is that after the COVID-19, there was a sudden stop of capital flows and a large unprecedented capital outflows from the emerging markets and from African countries in March and April of last year. So the IMF DSF cannot address this issue of large capital inflows and outflows from emerging market. And there was a liquidity crisis at that time last year. Also, the indicator of debt over GDP is misleading because debt is a stock of accumulated many years, and the GDP is a flow variable produced value added in 1 year. So that is misleading. So the second major problem of the IMF's DSF is that it doesn't distinguish the debt caused by public investment or the debt caused by consumption or what do you call it, recurrent expenditure of the government paying civil servant salaries or pensions. In the case of European countries, a lot of debt was caused by paying Social Security and pensions. So Justine Lin and myself, in our book, Going Beyond Aid, we criticized the IMF's DSF, saying that it kind of has anti-investment trend bias, anti-investment bias. It doesn't encourage any government investment in public infrastructure, in public assets. So there is an anti-investment bias. So I am all for combining asset and liability in the balance sheet approach. And I like very much the quotation that you made by German economist Christopher Trebeth, that combining asset and liability is a good way. In my recent paper with Kevin Gallagher at Boston University, we proposed using the public sector net worth, meaning asset minus liability as a measure of debt sustainability. The argument is based that if we build a public infrastructure, public assets, it can provide a cushion to the future debt issues. It can make the economy more productive and maybe addressing the bottlenecks in public infrastructure. So that was my first point.
Yeah.
The second point.
Would you mind if I just make that really clear for the audience? So just to be super clear, what you're saying is that when debt is taken up, when the debt sustainability framework is conducted, there's no serious analysis of what that debt is being spent on, and
right.
distinguishing whether you're building some sort of asset with the debt or whether you are just spending it.
Right, yes. DSF does not distinguish debt caused by investment or debt caused by consumption, meaning issuing salaries and pensions.
Right.
Yeah, so I'll my
second- Two very different, yes. Please go ahead, Dr. Wang.
My second point is China's role in Africa. China has been helping African countries, host countries, to build public infrastructure. That public infrastructure has formed public asset. And China has been helping releasing the bottlenecks. If you ask me, what is a good debt? I mean, my answer would be a good debt is a debt used to build public assets that releasing bottlenecks in growth, in infrastructure, in development. So many countries have a choking point of power shortage, electricity shortage. Donor countries have ignored power sector for many years. In Africa. So Justine Lin and myself, we did analysis on 214 completed projects, we found that 80% of them have addressed the bottlenecks in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So this was used, the data from ChinaAid data, the .com, all public accessible data. So we selected 214 completed infrastructure projects from 2010 to 2014. And we found that 80% of them have addressed the bottlenecks. So these should have higher rate of return mm-hmm. when we have addressed bottlenecks. The third point I want to make is that China's experience in the 1980s and the 90s may have some useful implications for African countries now. So we have done a lot of analysis in the book on going beyond aid. So in 1978, China and Japan has signed an agreement on energy for technology exchange. So it means that China exported crude oil, natural resources in exchange for technology. So that was related to the Shanghai Baoshan Steel Company. So in that agreement, Japan agreed to build the Shanghai Baoshan Steel Company, all the equipments, completed projects. And China exported the crude oil to Japan in that agreement. So as late as 1984, 50% of China's export was exporting crude oil and natural resources and agricultural. Did you have a question? So my second point in that experience is that later, China used the approach of processing trade using the OEM model. So at that time, a shortage of foreign exchange is very pressing. There was not enough foreign exchange to import materials for manufacturing shirts and etc. So China used OEM model, relied on 3+1 model, meaning that foreign business firms provides all the imported materials and the imported patents and also technology equipment into China. And then China export processed materials like shirts and shoes and socks and light manufacturing to the same company, to the advanced countries. It's called the 3+1 processing trade model. Thirdly, China used special economic zones to attract the foreign direct investment as a major way of releasing the bottlenecks in foreign exchange. So all the joint ventures companies, they have to achieve a self-sufficiency in foreign exchange. So right. Meaning they have to supply their own foreign exchange to import their materials and then export to advanced countries. All joint ventures are required to have foreign exchange self-sufficiency. So in that way, they can solve this need for foreign exchange. Right. So in the future, I think this has some implications for African countries, low-income countries to rely more on equity investment. That is foreign direct investment to develop their manufacturing sectors. So rely less on debt but rely more on equity investment. So right. That's my main 3 points.
Okay.
And then later I can answer questions.
That's great. That's great. That's one. And I think, I mean, you've taken us not just in terms of the critiques of the debt sustainability analysis directly, but I think what you're also saying in some ways is, and through your explanation of Chinese financing and a kind of a slightly different attitude in a sense to looking at debt sustainability, which exists because also of different models that China itself has used in terms of its own development experience. And that model, from what I can tell you're saying, is that model did include things like natural resource-based loans, which have been seen as, you know, very controversial, including by the IMF, in terms of being able to manage those flows, yet they were obviously fairly successful for China. And then beyond that, also looking at how you transition from international debt towards international equity, foreign direct investment, how you use that in the best way. These are long-term questions, right? Ma, what's your view in terms of, you know, right now for African economies, what are African economies thinking in terms of the debt sustainability framework? What are African leaders thinking about debt sustainability framework? And is it working for African economies, would you say?
Okay. Thank you, Hannah, for the introduction. And, you know, great points mentioned by Dr. Pinto and Dr. Wang. What I'll try to do is bring the discussion back home. So provide like a continent-specific analysis. First off, the pandemic affected nearly all the determinants of debt dynamics, right? It increased primary deficits where the sources of revenue for a lot of African countries, whether it's remittances, whether it's tourism, whether it's commodity exports, they were severely affected. And at the same time, we had to increase spending, particularly towards social sectors, you know, social protection programs, the health sector as well. And this occurred in a context where the continent was already grappling with high levels of debt, right? So before the pandemic sets in, 40% of the continent, their debt to GDP ratio was well above the 60% threshold that has been specified by the African Monetary Cooperation Program, right? Also, the pandemic caused a lot of exchange rate depreciations. So in Nigeria, for instance, we've had to depreciate the Naira 3 times since the pandemic started because our main source of foreign exchange, which is oil, has been significantly affected. And obviously you don't pay these external debts in your local currency. So it basically increases our debt service burden. Our economic output has been affected as well by external effects. Also the lockdown that was implemented at the peak of the pandemic. And regarding the challenges that the pandemic has uncovered with regards to the framework, the first challenge that I see is that over the years, the size of public debt has been grossly underestimated, right? So whereas before the pandemic started, the IMF, the framework stated that certain countries, you know, had sustainable debt levels. As soon as the pandemic started, we saw these same countries seeking large amounts of external financial assistance, you know, programs, and that's first off, you know, it's sort of brings the findings of the debt sustainability analysis into it sort of makes it debatable, yeah, basically. And so it's also closely aligns with what Dr. Pinto said earlier, where although the framework has started to include domestic debts in addition to external debts, there are still other forms of debts that are not being accounted for. So debts owed by SOEs, state-owned enterprises, you know, debts owed by para public entities, debts owed by subnational governments, private external indebtedness is also becoming a huge issue in the continent, and also the use of extra budgetary funds, which are not accounted for by the framework. Another point that is very important to note, and I think which Dr. Wang earlier mentioned, is the heavy focus on the debt to GDP ratio, right? So I'll give you a typical example. Nigeria, for instance, debt to GDP ratio is you know, below 30%, which to an extent seems sustainable. However, we currently spend 93% of our revenue servicing debts. So perhaps, you know, the framework should, you know, emphasize on the debt service to revenue ratio as a key metric for assessing whether the debt burden of countries are sustainable. Also, another thing is the framework doesn't, it heavily focuses on the historical trends of these determinants of debt dynamics, whether it's exchange rates or whether it's GDP growth, you know, there's not enough focus on in determining the scenarios, right, that inform these assessments. There's not enough focus on, you know, what happens if a natural disaster comes in, what happens if a pandemic comes in, right? Even though these are extreme scenarios, we've seen that it is possible. And if these scenarios are incorporated into the framework going forward, it would help countries that are invested in putting forward better debt management strategies to plan better. Now, with regards to what's African governments are thinking in terms of maybe putting up a new framework or a more informed framework, or you know, a framework that speaks to the context, right? What I do know is that we still rely on the IMF and the World Bank for the local debt sustainability analyses that are being conducted in the continent. So again, you know, these frameworks are still, you know, I won't say they're wrong, but at the same time, they can be better informed. Yeah, they can be improved.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so better informed in terms of the underlying situation and perhaps other metrics beyond debt to GDP ratios. I mean, yes, there are other metrics which are included, you know, even things like export to GDP and so on, but debt to GDP certainly gets a lot of focus in the analysis. And let me also just remind our audience before I pose another question to our panelists, let me just remind you, please do also put your questions into the Q&A section for our panelists. If you have some, hopefully we will certainly have time for discussing them. So make sure you add those. But let me continue with mine. I guess one of the other critiques of the framework is how does it marry up with future needs for finance? And I think it comes back to some degree to what Dr. Wang was saying in terms of the asset side, or you know, investment into infrastructure. It comes back to what you were saying, Umar, as well, in terms of, well, you know, what is sustainable? what do we mean by sustainable debt? Brian, what's your answer on that one? I mean, how can the IMF take that into account, or anyone take that into account? These are countries low income. Of course, they're going to need more finance, and they have less strong institutions in terms of banking sector, et cetera, to be able to generate that finance internally. So there's an external financing gap. How should the debt sustainability framework be adjusted to account for that? Or is it just not the right tool? Should we be looking at other tools?
Thanks, Hannah. First, let me, if you don't mind, just make a few observations on Dr. Wang's comments because I think it's important. I don't think that looking at the ratio of public debt to GDP is that bad. The question is how you do it. I think the problem is a conceptual one in the way it's incorporated in the LIC DSF. I'm much more partial to the sort of framework that that Ms. Ekeruche laid out, you know, where you do the traditional sorts of public debt dynamic analysis, looking at primary fiscal deficits, looking at real exchange rates, interest rates, contingent liabilities from state-owned enterprises or banks to get a fuller picture of what's going on. And I do think that there is a serious issue of measurement. If you really wanted to go down the path recommended by Justin Lin and Dr. Yang, I think just to have information on these assets would be a major challenge. The lack of data is a serious issue in Africa. And when you don't have good measurement, it's better to, sometimes you get more robust results from simpler frameworks rather than from more sophisticated frameworks. So actually, you know, right now the IMF LIC DSF is a black box. I mean, you put in these variables and outcome, these thresholds and these scenarios, but you really want to ask, what are they expecting in terms of real interest rates, growth rates, and that sort of thing. So in that respect, I also would say that I don't think that China is the best model for Africa. China has completely different governance. It has tremendous bargaining power, which it has used extremely well. You know, when I think of China and India, the country where I grew up, China has certainly used its bargaining power to attract FDI and technology much more effectively than India has. And I think, clearly it has done very well. But Africa, you know, we tend to talk about Africa, but really there are many countries there. And there's an issue of fragmentation and small size in many cases. I also think that one of the major issues in Africa is the misuse of public resources. You know, we have to accept that. We visited several countries when we were doing this work for the African Development Bank. Mm-hmm. And for example, in Uganda, there were concerns expressed about the ability to select and implement public investment projects well. Now, clearly bringing in China helps to alleviate that problem. It's what the economists call a principal agent problem, because China is coming in doing the infrastructure project. And when they finish, there is a bridge or a power station or a road or whatever. But here also, I think it's important to keep in mind, and certainly, you know, I think Dr. Wang said they now have a publicly available database of the projects. I think increased transparency in this is very good. For example, some of the things I picked up from very senior people in these countries was that many of them thought that the money from China was free because, you know, you would have the Chinese contractors coming in and saying, okay, we're going to build a hospital or a bridge or a road, or sometimes things that were not needed. And they never saw the money. The money never came to the country. The money would go directly from the China Development Bank or whatever to the contractor. And of course, then the country would get the bill to pay the debt. So I think while certainly it's very valuable to have China doing infrastructure in Africa, let's be absolutely clear about that. I think there needs to be a lot more transparency in the pricing of these projects, what it's costing in terms of pledging natural resources, and, you know, in terms of using that model. Because let's not forget that these countries already have a balance sheet which is in difficulty because of the misuse of public resources. And I think that perhaps Well, first of all, there are two issues in Africa. One is there's a lot of country heterogeneity. The LIC-DSF may be good for a small group of very poor countries that have no market access and that rely heavily on official funding. But I think for the other countries, more and more the experience from Latin America is becoming much more relevant. Mm-hmm. The so-called good debt that Dr. Yang was mentioning and which is mentioned in the title of the webinar is not new. There was something called the fiscal space controversy in Latin America, right, where Belize Tilly and Luis Servan and others had written papers, in fact, done a book saying that it didn't make sense for the World Bank and the IMF to insist that Latin American countries increase primary surpluses in order to place public debt on a trajectory, on a sustainable trajectory, because this forced them to cut good investments, in infrastructure, good public investments that had long run payoffs, which would support future growth and taxes. Mm-hmm. So in effect, you were shooting yourself in the foot by doing this. But as it turns out, the balance sheet, the existing balance sheet also has to be taken into account. And if you have credibility problems in how you've managed inflation or you've had past defaults, the market is not going to be that forgiving. And if you then, because the immediate impact of investing even in good infrastructure projects is to raise the debt to GDP ratio. The payoff might take 25, 30 years to come down the road.
Exactly.
So in fact, in the short run, interest rates could go up and create problems for you. Yes. So the first step for Latin America, and I believe also for the African countries, is to restore credibility in the management of the public finances. And then they can start talking about good debt.
There are a number of different economic points of view on whether interest rates will necessarily go up if you do increase fiscal spending, and US being the latest example where it doesn't necessarily, and these are debates which continue between economists. I guess the question is to what degree these issues, the ones that you point to, Dr. Pinto, are necessarily confined to low-income countries and certainly confined to African countries. I mean, misuse of public resources happens everywhere, and public debt to GDP ratios above 60% are also very typical, and especially in COVID-19 times, they're typical. So, but what is unique with regards to low-income countries is that they need to grow and they do need infrastructure. So let me put that question to Uma again,
I hadn't quite finished on that.
Yes.
I don't think it's clear that just given the scale of the investment needs in Africa, that even if you take an absolutely ideal situation, even in the best governed countries, you're going to have immediate problems with rising public debt and rising current account deficits. So clearly the existing framework is not suitable for how do you accommodate these vast development finance needs. And the debt sustainability framework is not the right tool to use to examine these questions. You need a different framework, and I can get into that. But I do think one has to be careful about saying, okay, in the US, the US, unfortunately, and even the Eurozone, they have different rules. They have different rules from the emerging markets and from the low-income countries. You can get away with things in the US and the Eurozone, which you cannot in Africa. And we know that from experience. We know, for example, that Argentina and Russia had their massive debt crises when the public debt to GDP ratio was far less than 60%. These situations are very country specific, and you have to do this on a case by case approach. And let me stop there, but yes. So to answer your question, the LIC-DSF is not a great tool for trying to reconcile debt sustainability with the vast development finance needs of these countries.
Yeah.
And you need a lot more, and I can get into that later.
What is there? Is there a framework? Is there an alternative framework for thinking through that reconciliation? And should that reconciliation happen?
Well, I know there's a framework, the Country Policy Institutional Assessment, CPIA. So there's the debt policy rating that assesses the quality of debt institutions, you know, your debt management institutions. Mm-hmm. And I know I did a paper once on it, and on the continent, there's no country that has reached the maximum points, which is it's a rank from 0 to 6. There's no country that has reached, you know, 6. I think the highest country is ranked 4 on that scale. And, you know, it goes back to what Dr. Pinto said. Yes, there's a lot of misuse of public funds. First off, there's some debts that are not being reported. They are unknown to the federal government, right? So there are subnational governments that borrow, you know, without the guidance of the debt management authority, without the knowledge or the guidance of the federal government, right? And obviously, this is not accounted for in the debt sustainability framework. And so while the debt sustainability framework might, you know, provide some form of, you know, guidance, or may give like a partial picture on the debt situation in a country, right? In some cases, it may be a bit off. And I think like that's what we're starting to see as the pandemic, you know, sets in, where countries that the framework previously said, you know, their debt was very much sustainable, you know, we're seeing them literally go into shock mode, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
But isn't part of that due to growth, as opposed a lack of growth and a lack of revenues, as opposed to debt itself? You know, the framework is meant to be debt and sustainability, but somehow, what do we mean by sustainability? It's very limited. And of course, as you say, there are a number of things that are missing. We have some questions coming up from the audience. And so I'm just going to ask Dr. Wang whether there's anything you would like to say on that point in terms of linking SDGs and DSF. In fact, one of the questions we've had from the audience, Claire von Lasek has asked, should progress on SDGs be incorporated into the debt sustainability framework? I can't tell whether that is about asking whether countries are doing enough, and kind of asking countries to meet more thresholds than they already are within the IMF threshold, or whether it is about, you know, saying, well, what is the distance to SDGs that countries need to travel, and using that framework with the DSF. But Dr. Wang, what's your thoughts on this question?
In my own view, that SDG is a long-term goal, and many aspects, 17 goals. So DSF is a very narrow framework. So it's very difficult to incorporate the SDG into DSF, which is a short-term framework looking at the debt accumulated over the years divided by GDP and the present value and so forth. So it's very narrow. As I agree with Brian Pinto's point that we need a broader, much broader framework for the long-term analysis of infrastructure needs and sustainable green energy need in African countries, and how to finance them. My point regarding the asset and liability is that China's approach based on its own experience is that in terms of shortage of foreign exchange in the low-income countries, LEAC countries, you can use the approach I mentioned, resource for infrastructure, resource for high technology, resource for complete set of plants, like Baoshan Steel Company. It was financed mainly by resources. And secondly, you can use processing trade and reduce the need for foreign exchange. in my paper with Justin Lin is that all foreign businessmen, they supply all the imported materials for the country to further process that and then export the light manufacturing products and earn foreign exchange. Thirdly, you can use a special economic zone to attract foreign direct investment. Then all the foreign joint ventures, they have to reach self-sufficiency in foreign exchange. That will reduce the need for borrowing debt and borrowing in foreign exchange. So that's my point.
Thanks, Dr. Wang. And I guess the issue is that especially with COVID-19 coming in and having to spend on healthcare and also on economic recovery and supporting vulnerable citizens through COVID-19, especially and waiting and spending money on vaccines as well, although, you know, thankfully there are donations slowly coming through. Countries are under a great deal of pressure, and that foreign exchange is in very, very short supply. Ma, you have a point to share here as well.
Yes, please, Hannah. So with regards to what policymakers can take home, I think debt for equity swaps are becoming more popular. I know Dr. Wang earlier mentioned, you know, debt swaps. You know, these are becoming more popular. In Nigeria, I know that in 2005, we had the debt for development swap with the World Bank and IMF under the Multilateral Debt Relief Initiative. So I think that's one approach that policymakers on the continent can take. Then also with regards to the resource for infrastructure, resource for technology arguments that is being put forward. So I'm going to be speaking from the debtor country perspective, right? While that may be great for the creditor country, what usually happens is that there's no spillover. So rather than provide these loans to the debtor government and allow their human resources, you know, their companies use these loans and you know, develop or build this infrastructure, right? When you do the sort of bargaining that is being done by, you know, with China and a lot of African countries, there's very little room for local workers to gain expertise. You know, there's very little room for them to even be employed, right? So a typical example is in Abuja here in Nigeria, the China Civil Engineering Corporation, they are the ones involved in, you know, rebuilding the airports or upgrading the airports. They're also building, you know, train tracks, right? And while that is good, it ensures that in some cases, it ensures that the debt is actually being put to good use, because then the creditors that are borrowing these funds, they are following up the implementation process, right, of the funds. But at the same time, there are local companies that you know, could have handled these activities, right? And then it would help money circulate, you know, in the economy. You know, technology spillovers, you know, knowledge transfers. There's a lot that gets missing when we overly rely on these resource for infrastructure, resource for technology, you know, approaches.
I'm going to refer you to a report that we did recently with the Oxford China International Consultancy in partnership, and we did a cross-country study of African economies based using CICE-CARI, John Hopkins CICE-CARI data, and we examined and created a new framework for looking at different labor laws in African countries. So there's a slight detour, but we did look at the question of whether African countries are getting more from being able to negotiating more for labor contracts to be able to have more local employees. And it looks like there are some countries that are using that bargaining power, as Dr. Pinto was talking about earlier on, actually trying to use that bargaining power much more for contracts these days. But it's obviously something that's still in progress. We will also have another webinar in this series, which will be looking at how African countries can be working together more to get more out of contracts and out of other strategic aspects of their relationship with China and others. So definitely that will be really important, and it is very important in terms of Africa's future. But I guess the question too is, the IMF is also very important to Africa's future, and the IMF and World Bank views, you know, whether it's expressed through debt sustainability framework, CPIA, as you mentioned, Uma, these also affect African countries' ability to go forward and meet SDGs as well. Brian, Dr. Pinto, you had a few more points. I'm going to encourage our audience, please do send in more questions for our panelists if you have some. Otherwise, I will also put an almost final question to our panelists before we answer our last poll of this webinar.
Yes,
Hannah. Yes, you wanted to say a little bit more about SDGs, I think.
Right. Well, first of all, the present framework, you know, I fully agree with Jan and with Mama that this is not a good framework for, I mean, it's just not geared for that. Because, you know, even if you took the best governed countries in Africa, Rwanda, Kenya, Ethiopia, these, at least Ethiopia, unfortunately, before the recent resurgence of political instability, these were considered among the best governed countries with close to the highest CPIAs. It's clear that their investment needs are so huge that you're going to cross those debt thresholds and you're going to be in a state of debt distress. So the point here though is that you have to look at the other side of the coin, which is to acknowledge that the present system of concessional official development assistance, or concessional ODA, that framework needs to be re-examined, because in spite of the HIPC MDRI reduction in debt, you know, as of 2018, when we were doing this work for the African Development Bank, they did not seem to be a strong foundation either for debt sustainability or for sustained long-run growth. Mm. And you know, so the question is, why isn't this working? And essentially we proposed three things. One was that the investment needs are vast and you cannot rely on market finance for these investment needs. At the same time, for many African countries, except the poorest ones, the market is now determining the marginal cost of borrowing through euro bonds or through treasury bills in the domestic market, often at very high interest rates. For example, I understand that Cote d'Ivoire recently issued a 30-year euro bond at 5% or thereabouts. So the question is, can we move away from concessionality, which seems to be overrated, to what we would call a moderately concessional framework for those countries that, you know, where the marginal cost of borrowing is being determined by the market? Mm-hmm. And can you bring money forward? The trouble is that by definition, you need a lot of money upfront for the African countries. And one way of doing it is to take a portion of the grants that the African countries are now given and use that to securitize what we called a big bond. For example, when we did the calculation in 2017, at that time, the 30-year US Treasury yield was about 3%. And then if you took about $5 billion of the $45 billion in grants that Africa was then getting, so about 11% of that, and set it aside, you could use that to finance $100 billion upfront. So now you're talking. You talk about $100 billion. You immediately raise the stakes. But at the same time, you have to recognize that there are problems with economic governance, you know, with the misuse of public resources. And therefore, you need a stepped up policy dialogue. You need much more collaboration across the World Bank, the IMF, the African Development Bank. Right now, you have a lot of turf protection. You have a very fragmented approach. So you need better economic governance in Africa, and you need a stronger policy dialogue. So you need to have more money, but you need to raise the bar for access to this. And, you know, essentially start a race to the top in Africa, you know, develop a more encouraging narrative going forward. And so you need this combination of money upfront. You need what we call an enhanced policy dialogue. And third, since the donors themselves have problems in their own countries, you know, high unemployment in Italy and other countries, very high youth unemployment, in order to make this attractive to them, say, okay, we're not asking you for more money. We're just saying, take your existing envelope of resources and use it more imaginatively to engender incentives for better performance by the African countries. Now, I like very much what Meme said about the debt equity swaps. And in fact, Ethiopia is a good example. China has invested heavily there. We have all these infrastructure projects. And of course, we know that the payback period for these infrastructure projects could be 30 or 40 years. So would China be willing to convert some of its loans to Ethiopia into equity positions? Would it be able to use its good offices to have Chinese textile and garment companies invest in Ethiopia, you know, to provide the other side of the coin, in order that these projects can then be seen as actually supporting long-run growth and taxes and thereby contributing to fiscal solvency? So let me stop there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's plenty of Chinese policymakers, probably including and academics, including Dr. Wang, who would say that's exactly what China's doing in some ways, but maybe there's definitely scope for more. And I'm sure also plenty African policymakers think that too. Okay, I'm going to ask you all one final question to finish off before we do our poll. And that will be, if you were to advise African leaders now what to do with respect to debt sustainability, the debt sustainability frameworks, if anything, what would you suggest they do? So not in terms of their own policies necessarily, but with regards to when they're speaking or working with the IMF, World Bank, but in particular IMF, what should they be doing? What should they be trying to get out of that relationship and the debt sustainability framework as it is? So Dr. Wang, could I ask you to kick off with that one?
Oh, it's a very long and difficult question. So in my view, first, the countries should pursue and consistent pursue multilateralism, including the Chinese government. They should support the World Bank, IMF's issuing more SDR. So for the IMF to issue more SDRs and for the World Bank to issue more liquidity loans. Secondly, Chinese policymakers should reform their own foreign aid framework. Chinese policymakers should draft and pass, implement a foreign aid law, and including transparency, accountability, and sustainability requirements. Thirdly, for African low-income countries, they should think about less debt and more equity investment in their own country. Try to attract foreign direct investment to their own country using all forms of special economic zones and et cetera. Develop their own manufacturing and export capacity. With the export capacity, they can earn more foreign exchange. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So take the debt sustainability analysis as given and focus more on equity. All right. How about yourself, Brian, Dr. Pinto?
Thank you. I think that the leaders of the African countries need to rest the initiative and, you know, define their own agenda. They need to take charge. They need really to lead. First and foremost, they should lower political risk by managing domestic sources of volatility well. Now, we actually have a concrete example from Kenya. When President Kibaki took over in 2002 from President Arap Moi, there was a very peaceful transition of power. And what happened was that political risk went down, investment horizons lengthened for the private sector, interest rates came down, the Kenyan shilling actually started appreciating in nominal terms, suddenly debt dynamics improved. And this, of course, was very good for that. You know, people were thinking that Kenya could start issuing 10-year or 20-year debt in its own markets. But then, unfortunately, we had the debacle in December 2007. So this is something that I think is absolutely at the top of the agenda. How do you lower political risk? How do you eliminate corruption, favoritism, social conflict? You know, how do you deal with this? This is a very big agenda for African countries, and it closely affects the horizon for the private sector. It affects interest rates, and related to this, of course, part of this, concretely, what does it mean to do all this? It means manage the public finances well. Good or bad governance finds its most immediate and direct expression in the management of the public finances. And especially now that so many African countries are discussing natural resources. Mozambique had this huge natural gas discovery, but then it got into a debt crisis. But the debt crisis and the hidden debt came to light only because gas prices fell. So the question is, how do you use these resources for the benefit of the whole country, the current generation and future generations? In Nigeria, they did extremely well during the second Obasanjo administration when Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, as the finance minister, renegotiated their debt with the Paris Club. But then that didn't last, and now they've gone back to multiple exchange rates and parallel exchange rates, even though we know that this is not the best for Nigeria, because every time you sell your oil dollars at the official exchange rate, you're losing money relative to the market rate. And that has a bad impact on the fiscal deficit, you know, the hidden fiscal deficits. So manage your public finances well. And the third thing is, you have to recognize that you cannot separate the debt sustainability agenda from the growth policy agenda. So of course, I take your point also, Hannah, that African countries have to begin defining their own destiny. You know, I would love to see a summit of the African leaders with, the president of the World Bank, the managing director of the IMF, and the president of the African Development Bank, and donors meeting together to talk about the way forward. Because, you know, you have to look at it from both sides, you know, the debt sustainability frameworks and the aid architecture.
Thank you, Brian. So yeah, a mix of both of that, of those, and also come together with IMF and World Bank, discuss the way forward. How about you, Mike? You've got the last word.
Yeah, Hannah, first off, thank you, Dr. Pinto, for schooling me on the Nigerian MDRI, Yeah, so the two main policy recommendations that I would like to put forward for governments across the continent are, first, with regards to the debt sustainability framework specifically, right, to encourage that a more comprehensive analysis be conducted to include all forms of debts. Yes, there are challenges with data across the continent, but that has improved significantly over time. you know, data is becoming more available. So debts owed by SOEs, all the contingent liabilities, we hear a lot of hidden debts, you know, extra budgetary, you know, funds, all these should be included and incorporated in the analysis to provide a more you know, comprehensive and realistic picture of things, and definitely improve debt reporting. The second recommendation that I would like to put forward is to strengthen institutions, particularly the debt management authorities. Aside from establishing these regulatory authorities, right, it's important that they are autonomous, so the federal government doesn't necessarily, or you know, doesn't just wake up and tell them, you know, we want this money to fund this budget, and then they go on and, you know, they go to the capital markets and issue bonds. No, so it's important that they're autonomous to a large extent. It's important that they have the local capacity to conduct these you know, analysis in-house. It's important that they also have a say in it with regards to debt use, right? So they're not just there to determine when governments should borrow and when they shouldn't borrow, but they should also very much have a say in what this debt is used for. And hopefully, if these things are put in place, it will curb overly optimistic expectations, it will curb imprudent lending and make financing terms stricter for those countries that need, you know, stricter terms, and also enforce the need for putting debts to good use.
Great. Thank you so much for those recommendations. We were drawing, we found actually when we were writing a guide to debt in 20 African countries just recently, the Nigerian Debt Management Office seemed to actually be a really shining example of that transparency.
Yes, we are.
Certainly do encourage more countries to do exactly the same, and, you know, kind of grab that opportunity for sure. And maybe do what Dr. Wang said as well, not just look at liabilities, but also look at assets. And that could also be useful. All right. That brings our discussion to a close. I would like to now put our poll to our audience. Let's see what they think. You've given your opinions, panelists, expert opinions. Really grateful for that. Let's see what our panel, our audience think about the question of this seminar. In light of the SDGs, COVID-19 and Africa's financing needs, do you, our audience, think the IMF's debt sustainability framework should be reviewed? And you've got three options there. Yes, as soon as possible. Two, I don't think it will make any difference, even if it was possible. And three, no way, don't reform it. It's the right framework for the future. Let's see what the audience have said. Let's give it a couple more seconds. Send in your votes. Okay, let's close it now. Let's see what the answers are. Okay, right. We have a very strong view from the audience. Yes, the sustainability framework should be reviewed as soon as possible. 86% say that. And we have one saying, I don't think it will make any difference. And nobody thinks that it's the right framework for the future. Well, thank you, audience. Thank you for your engagement. And let me also say thank you again to our panelists for joining us today. Really, we learned so much from you, and it was great to discuss these issues with you. I'd also like to say thank you to the Development Reimagined team who've been putting this together. Really fantastic. And also to our translators who have dealt with some fairly technical terms today, but I hope it's gone okay for you. Thank you again for all your support. All right, and that is our last webinar that's our webinar for today. Next week, we'll have another webinar, so please stay tuned and tweet about it. Let us know what you thought, send your feedback, and look forward to discussing again with you next time. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.